This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is set to visit the White House later today for talks with President Joe Biden about Iran, security issues, and the coronavirus pandemic. The meeting will be the first time the two leaders speak in person since Bennett became prime minister in June. Major focus of the talks will be Iran, both its nuclear program and what the official called the country's destabilizing activities in the region. The U.S. and Iran have held several rounds of indirect talks about rejoining the 2015 international agreement that limited Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanction relief. That agreement came about amid concerns Iran was working to develop nuclear weapons, which it has denied. Bennett said earlier this week he will tell President Biden that it is time to stop the Iranians, not to give them a lifeline in the form of reentering into an expired nuclear deal. The U.S. government is pledging to continue efforts to extradite Americans, U.S. permanent residents, allies, and other vulnerable Afghans, even if it means going past the end-of-the-month deadline for American forces to leave Afghanistan. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Wednesday there is no deadline in getting out Americans and Afghans who want to leave past August 31st. The State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House officials continue to rebuke criticism about chaos at the gates of Kabul's airport, emphasizing the success of flying out more than 82,000 people since the end of July, nearly half of them women and children. As many as 1,500 American civilians remain in Afghanistan. By remote, this is VOA News. The Australian government on Thursday advised its citizens not to travel to Kabul's airport, where there is a very high threat of terrorist attacks, according to a government spokesperson. Australians and Afghan Australian visa holders in the airport's vicinity were advised to move to a safe location and await further advice. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne said the travel advice was consistent with revised British and New Zealand advice. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Australia has helped evacuate around 4,000 people from the airport since Wednesday last week, including 1,200 overnight. U.S. military troops have been ordered to get vaccinated for COVID-19 immediately, according to a memo released by the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. The order came 2 days after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration gave final approval to Pfizer's vaccine, paving the way for more than 800,000 unvaccinated service members to get shots. The U.S. military will administer these shots to troops stationed in the U.S. and around the world. Service members also can choose to get vaccinated on their own. The order only applies to Pfizer's vaccine. Moderna has applied to the FDA for full approval of its vaccine. Johnson & Johnson said it hopes to apply later this year. An official says Poland has ended its evacuations from Afghanistan as the clock ticks down on a dramatic Western effort to help people flee. Polish officials say a group of people taken from Kabul who are now in Uzbekistan are the last evacuated by Poland, adding the nation made its decision to not continue operations after starting with the U.S. and British officials. President Biden declared he's sticking to the August 31st deadline for completing the American pullout, as the Taliban insists that he must. The World Food Program is appealing for $200 million to purchase millions of food for Afghans before the winter snow cuts off access to roads to them. The WFP regional director warned of humanitarian crisis this winter without international support for this emergency operation. As always, for details on more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
welcome to the Break Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda welcomes the first batch of Afghan refugees.
It is a Ugandan culture that once you are at your home and somebody comes running for safety, even if I don't know you, once you come running, our tradition, our culture is that we open for you so that you can have peace.
East Africa truckers suspend transportation of cargo to South Sudan. Heavily armed gunmen killed two Tanzanian police officers in Dar es Salaam. Frosty relations between Kenya's president and his deputy continue. And Malawi braces for another election challenge case a year after President Chakwera's election.
My client believes strongly that the election that took place on the 23rd June, electing President Chakwera, is also null and void, because the principle of the law is very clear. Out of nothing comes nothing.
And Africa has been declared wild polio-free. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda has started receiving Afghan refugees, as 51 of them, the first batch of the 2,000 expected in the country, arrived in Kampala early Wednesday. The evacuees will settle in Uganda temporarily before their next place of permanent residence. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakariji has more from Kampala.
Kuriswa Ryomunzi, Uganda government spokesperson, told journalists in Kampala this Monday that accepting the Afghans is both a moral obligation and Uganda's welcoming culture to help people fleeing from danger.
It is a Ugandan culture that once you are at your home and somebody comes running for safety, usually we open our doors. Even a basic home in any part of the country, even if I don't know you, once you come running for safety, our tradition, our culture is that we open for you so that you can have peace. So it is the same hospitality phenomenon that we have used to receive refugees.
Uganda is home to at least 1.5 million refugees, mainly from neighboring South Sudan and Democratic Republic of Congo. But Yomun said the Afghan evacuees are coming to Uganda through an arrangement between the U.S. government and Uganda. The situation in Afghanistan became more volatile after the Taliban took over Kabul earlier this month. Johnny Mulimba, Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, addressed Parliament after witnessing the first batch of Afghan evacuees arrive in Uganda.
This morning, 50 evacuees from Afghanistan arrived in the country aboard a private red chartered flight and were received by government officials and the United States Embassy at Entebbe International Airport. The evacuees included men, women, and children. The evacuees will remain in Uganda while they are processed by the U.S. Embassy for their onward journey.
Mulimba also said Uganda is working on a way to evacuate the two remaining Ugandan nationals in Afghanistan after others had been evacuated to the U.K. by their employers. Joel Senyon, the spokesperson for opposition National Unity Platform Party, also welcomed Uganda's gesture to accommodate the Afghans.
It's the right thing to do. It's even good manners, if you like, for us to be able to host refugees, because we too can be refugees at some point. Ugandans can be refugees at some point, if anything we were. Remember, in the past, many Ugandans had to run to Kenya and elsewhere. So it's the right thing to do.
In a statement, the U.S. Embassy in Kampala praised Uganda for accepting to host the Afghans. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji, Kampala, Uganda.
East Africa truckers have suspended transportation of cargo to South Sudan following the killings of two Kenyan drivers and the disappearances of others over the weekend. The drivers have for several years been targets of attacks by armed people along the Juba-Nimule route. As Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala, the truck drivers are seeking assurances of their safety before resuming work.
Just about 4 months after the last sit-down strike by long-distance truckers at the Elegu border post along the Uganda-South Sudan border, the drivers are back at it again. They are protesting the deaths of two Kenyan drivers, Harun Abdullahi and Issa Salad, who were killed Sunday along the Juba-Nimule road as they transported merchandise to South Sudan. The drivers also told VOA that the slain truckers were among 46 destined for South Sudan, adding that the whereabouts of another 15 in the group are still unknown. About 300 trucks are currently parked at Elegu as the drivers demand the bodies and trucks of the deceased drivers, as well as information on the whereabouts of the missing. Before ending a similar 10-day protest early this year, The truckers were promised security along the route. Sudi Mwatela Kauli is the chairperson of the Long Distance Truck Drivers Association. He told the media at Elegu that the truckers are disappointed over failure by South Sudan authorities to fulfill their promise.
Drivers have decided to park their vehicle until their security is guaranteed. Because this one is not first time. We were here on April 9th because of the same issue. We agreed that they were going to issue with escort, but they did not provide. They tried to put the escort with the patrols, but after 1 week, they packed the cruisers and relaxed.
This is the fourth time within 5 weeks that truckers have come under fire along the same route. The latest was in July, when two Ugandan truckers were injured by men in South Sudan military uniforms. David Ongom Mudong is a spokesperson for Uganda's Aswa River Regional Police. In an interview with VOA, Mudongo urged traders and truckers to exercise caution while plying the South Sudan routes.
So as the police, we would wish to inform the general public, especially Ugandan citizens, that South Sudan is still not safe for drivers and other travelers. Ugandans therefore need to be extra vigilant about the current insecurity situation in South Sudan, especially along the routes.
Armed violence against truckers has increased along the Juba-Nimule route since 2016. With South Sudan being a landlocked country, the continued attacks are feared to threaten business in Africa's youngest nation and the East Africa regional bloc. On average, about 120 trucks cross the Elegu border for South Sudan daily. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Malawi's Constitutional Court has agreed to hear a challenge to last year's presidential election rerun from the opposition Democratic Progressive Party. President Lazarus Chakwera defeated the DPP's Peter Mutharika in the rerun after the court nullified the 2019 election, which Mutharika had won. The DPP argues that the rerun should also be nullified after the High Court quashed the appointment of four DPP commissioners to the Malawi Electoral Commission. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
This past June, the High Court quashed the appointment of four DPP commissioners, Jean Matanga, Linda Kunje, Steve Dua, and Arthur Nantulu, saying their appointment was invalid and unconstitutional. The court acted after the governing Malawi Congress Party had challenged the appointment of the commissioners. Judge Kenyatta Nyirenda further said the quashing of the appointments did not affect the validity of the June 2020 rerun presidential election. But the opposition DPP said Nyirenda erred in his ruling because he touched on issues beyond his mandate. The party wants the court to also invalidate the rerun election because it was managed by commissioners who it says were wrongly appointed. They argue that the Malawi Constitution does not recognize an election that was presided over by undeserving commissioners. Charles Muhango is a lawyer for the opposition DPP.
My clients believe strongly that the election that took place on 23rd June, electing President Chakwera, is also null and void because the principle of the law is very clear. Out of nothing comes nothing.
Critics fear the case will result in another long and protracted legal battle, which will cost the government a lot of money. They believe the case could have been avoided had the government listened to the advice of the former Attorney General, Chikosa Silungwe, that the government should recognize the commissioners. Osman Kennedy is a law lecturer at the Blantyre International University. He told VOA that serious implications will happen only if the court rules in favor of the DPP.
Because what is going to happen is that we will revert back to 2020 when Mutharika was the president. Because then the court may say, no, if you were not properly elected or you were declared president by a commission that was illegal, then you were not elected, you were no longer the president. And therefore, we are reverting the status quo back to Mutharika and Chilima. Respectively.
Social commentator Humphrey Mvula said the case demonstrates failure by political leaders to accept electoral defeat.
Our challenge as most African countries, including Malawi, is we rarely accept that we've lost some elections. We will always want to fight on, and We always want the court to tell us that we have lost. Even at that time, we will be able to trust the decision of the court.
Former President Mutharika has said he does not recognize results of the Rerun election he lost to Chakwera. In the meantime, the Constitutional Court has set Monday next week to decide whether to proceed with the case, and if so, how. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 26th. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto have had yet another altercation in their ongoing frosty relations. During a joint interview with media editors earlier this week, President Kenyatta, for the second time, openly dared his deputy of 9 years and running mate in 2 elections to resign if Mr. Ruto was not satisfied with the government. As Atieno Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the deputy president did not hesitate to respond.
In a joint interview with media editors at State House on Monday this week, President Kenyatta took issues with Deputy President and criticized him for opposing a government he is part of, saying Ruto was confusing the public.
And it would be really the honorable thing that if you are not happy with it, that you would actually, you know, step aside and allow those who want to move on, because you can't have your cake and eat it. You know, on the one hand, you want to sing the praises of a government that you are saying that, yes, you know, this is, we have done, and you want to ride on them. But yet on the other side of your mouth, you're talking another language.
The president also broke his silence on Friday's Court of Appeals decision to throw out the Building Bridges Initiative, BBI, saying the judgment was not a personal loss to him, but rather to Kenyans.
Unfortunately, the courts have ruled the way they have ruled, and I believe that they have been highly misguided in that process. Unfortunately, I will accept and move on. I don't agree with it because I believe we have denied Kenyans their resources. We have denied Kenyans equity. So this is what Kenyans have lost. I, Uhuru, have not lost anything.
A day after, and in an apparent response to the president, Deputy President Ruto said he would not resign nor back out of his pursuit for the presidency in the coming 2022 elections. Mr. Ruto also lauded the judiciary for throwing out the proposed constitutional amendment through the BBI, saying the bill was not in the interest of Kenyans.
I have no space to retreat, and I don't have the luxury of surrendering. I am marching forward because we want to transform this nation. We fought for almost 30 years against an imperial presidency. The BBI was going to install the imperial presidency in a very unprecedented way. How will you account that the BBI was suggesting that we have a president who controls the legislature and controls the judiciary using the ombudsman? BBI was dangerous for Kenya.
A section of President Kenyatta's allies are backing him up and have threatened to revive an impeachment motion to get the deputy president out of the way. Maina Kamanda is a nominated member of parliament.
We passed that BBI the other day in the parliament, and the same can be repeated, and we sent him home. Me and the views, if we can agree as members of parliament, we take this member because he doesn't want to go, and we pass a motion of no confidence in parliament.
Deputy President Ruto's allies have also come to his defense, alleging that he has been maltreated in the government by his boss since the onset of the handshake between President Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga. Senator Mithika Linturi says the deputy president will not succumb to any pressure to resign.
Ruto is an institution. He is not himself. We will not allow him to resign. That I can tell you, he won't. He can only resign by virtue of him feeling that I can't serve in this position out of goodwill. But there is no amount of pressure or intimidation that will make William Ruto to resign.
This is the second time in just 3 months and barely 1 year to the general elections that the president has dared his deputy to resign from government rather than continually criticizing it from within. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
A heavily armed gunman fatally shot three police officers and a security guard in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, on Wednesday near a French embassy building. Police later killed the man whose intended target and motive were not immediately clear. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
A gunman near the French embassy in Dar es Salaam opened fire on Wednesday, creating fear among the residents. The Inspector General of Police, Simon Siro, confirmed the incident a few hours later, but did not disclose details about the shooting or the suspect. The police chief said, "We have lost our two soldiers, but the man who carried out the murder was also killed. But we want to know where he came from and who he is, and I will give you the information later." Shortly afterward, officials confirmed the death of another police officer and a security guard in the shooting. The attack came just hours after President Samia Suluhu Hassan met with police officials. Eyewitnesses say the shooting caused panic. Daudi Mwamala is an Uber driver who was at the scene. Those with cars at the front didn't have any chance to reverse their cars or anything, Mwamala said. What they did was open their car doors and run, and some of the traffic police were also running. Juma Selemani, a Dar es Salaam resident, says he thought police officers were firing shots to stop a bank robbery. At first, he said, "We were not scared as we thought maybe they were soldiers continuing with their work. But later, we saw a man firing bullets in the air." He added that one traffic policeman said, "My fellow officer has died." The U.S. Embassy in Tanzania has issued a security alert warning its citizens to avoid the area. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
The World Health Organization Africa region has declared Africa wild polio-free after the region recorded zero polio deaths in two consecutive years. Speaking during the virtual 71st session of the WHO Regional Committee for Africa, World Health Organization Regional Director for Africa, Dr. Mashidiso Mwite, said the region has been certified free of wild polio due to strong vaccination campaigns, improved surveillance, and closed coordination. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, persistent issues like localized outbreaks in under-humanized communities remain a challenge.
It is more than 2 years now since wild polio killed African children. In 2016, the last case of wild circulating polio was reported in Nigeria, where the disease was endemic, with no more cases reported in the past years. The World Health Organization yesterday Wednesday officially declared Africa polio-free. Speaking during the 71st session of the World Health Organization Regional Committee for African Health Ministers, WHO Regional Director Dr. Mashidiso Moet said that despite the COVID-19 pandemic, more than 95 million children in Africa were vaccinated against polio.
I'm pleased that the region remains free of this form of the disease, knowing that this certification occurred just before governments had to mount rapid efforts to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. After the pause in polio activities due to COVID-19 restrictions, close to 100 million children in 21 countries in the region have been vaccinated since the campaigns resumed in July last year.
The resources and expertise used to eliminate wild polio have significantly contributed to Africa's public health and outbreak response system. Dr. Moet says that the African region has committed to ending all forms of polio for good and working towards a future where no child in Africa is paralyzed by polio.
We have achieved a monumental public health milestone, and we are close to stopping all forms of polio. By maintaining our focus and working together in this last mile, we can ensure our success becomes a legacy of better health for future generations.
In East African region, incredible progress have been made in polio eradication over the last decades. Dr. Timothy Musila, senior health planner at Ministry of Health Uganda, said that polio vaccine uptake in Uganda and in the region has shown positive results.
The uptake of these vaccines has been very good and has been able to control the problem. But Madam Chair, as you know, the current OPV has caused a number of challenges. And in the region, we have got a number of circulating viruses within our region. In July this year, Uganda identified the circulating vaccine-derived virus from two of our environmental sites in Kampala. And for that matter, Uganda is going to conduct a national campaign targeting all children under 5 years.
The WHO General Director, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, said that ending wild poliovirus in Africa is one of the greatest public health achievements.
The African region showed tremendous perseverance to overcome adversity and defeat wild polio. Governments must continue to show strength and seize this incredible opportunity to end all forms of polio across Africa.
Polio was one of the most feared diseases in industrialized countries, paralyzing hundreds of thousands of children every year. But with the introduction of effective vaccines, polio has been brought under control and practically eliminated as a public health problem in many countries. Only two countries worldwide, that is Pakistan and Afghanistan, continue to see wild poliovirus transmission. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jiembo in Milwaukee, USA.
The former president of Chad, Issa Habre, died Monday this week at age 79, 5 years into a life sentence for war crimes and crimes against humanity. His trial in Senegal marked the first time that an African country tried a former leader of another African country for crimes committed in Africa. However, Habre's conviction was less than perfect justice, as Annika Hamishlaw reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Issène Habré oversaw the killing and torture of tens of thousands of people during his rule as Chad's president from 1982 to 1990. He was also accused of rape and sexual slavery. At the time, Habré received support from the United States and France to defend against Libya's invasions in northern Chad. He was found guilty of crimes against humanity in 2016 by a Senegalese court and was still serving his life sentence when he died while being treated for COVID-19. Alan Ngari is the Organized Crime Observatory Coordinator for West Africa with the Institute of Security Studies in Dakar.
It was the first time for universal jurisdiction to be successful in Africa. It was the first time that a former head of state was found guilty for personally committing acts of rape. But it came almost 26 years later from when he was deposed from presidency in Chad.
Habré's victims and their supporters worked tirelessly over those years to bring the former dictator to justice. Reed Brody is a member of the International Commission of Jurists and a human rights lawyer who has worked with Habré's victims since 1999.
That a band of torture victims never gave up and were able to turn the tables and bring a dictator to justice in Africa before an African court. These are enormous achievements that I feel proud of, that I know the victims feel proud of.
One of those victims is Clément Abaifuta, the president of the Association of Victims of the Crimes of the Issène Habré Regime. Abaifuta endured 4 years of torture at the hands of Habré's regime. During that time, he not only witnessed the deaths of many of his co-detainees from torture, illness, and sexual violence, but he was forced to dig their graves. He says when Issène Habré was convicted, all of Africa celebrated and jumped for joy because Africans proved they were capable of trying dictators on African soil. He says the case of Issène Habré is a lesson for all dictators. You cannot hide. Justice is like the sun. It will always catch you. Habré and the Chadian government were ordered to pay Abaifuta and the other victims tens of millions of dollars, and the African Union was tasked with setting up a trust fund. The victims, however, have yet to see a penny, and the fund was never established. Abaifuta said he will continue to pressure the Senegalese authorities and the African Union to begin the process of reparations. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
And that's it for this Thursday, August 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, who is filling in this week for Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.